This is Conducting Business, a podcast on the music industry from WQXR.org. I'm Naomi Lewin. Osvaldo Golijov, one of today's most successful composers, is facing accusations of plagiarism. Sidarius, a nine-minute piece commissioned by a group of 35 orchestras, contains a significant chunk of music from a 2009 work by Michael Ward Bergman, a close friend of Golijov's. The similarity was discovered by Tom Manoff, a music critic for NPR's All Things Considered, and Brian McWhorter, a trumpet player. A composer recycling another composer's melody is hardly unknown, and in this case, Ward Bergman had authorized Golijov to use his music. But where does borrowing cross the line? Here to offer their take are three guests. Anne Majette is the classical music critic of The Washington Post. She joins us from the newsroom there. David Smook is a composer and chair of the music theory department at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. He is on the phone. And in the studio with me is Robert Clarida, an intellectual property lawyer at Reitler, Kalis, and Rosenblatt, and he is also a composer.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Okay, Anne, I'm going to start with you. Is it plagiarism if Osvaldo Golijov got explicit written permission from the composer whose work he incorporated?
I think by definition it's not plagiarism if the person who is supposedly being plagiarized authorized the use and has said that he doesn't mind it, which Ward Bergman did explicitly say. I think it's plagiarism when the borrowing is not acknowledged, and I think that the reason that this instance has raised flags is that while Golijov credited Ward Bergman for the melody, he did not mention just how much of the piece he had actually incorporated. And the fact that that had to be discovered by an NPR producer and a trumpet player who were in the audience rather than be in the program notes is what created the furor. But of course, Golijov has worked collaboratively for most of his career, incorporating music by other composers, often explicitly with their sanction and blessing.
So I guess the further question would be, if all of these orchestras paid for a piece by Golijov, is it wrong that they're getting a piece that is in large part or in some part not by Golijov?
Well, there's a famous quote from Stravinsky, which I've already quoted in regard to this situation, that good composers borrow and great composers steal. And everybody in the music world loves that quote and chortles about it. So the idea that we're suddenly becoming prurient because Golijov took a chunk of music from somebody else seems to me slightly hypocritical. I think the issue is more that people feel that somehow the wool has been pulled over their eyes because this piece is not by Golijov. And since Golijov has always worked in this kind of collage pastiche way, I think that maybe people haven't quite fully been paying attention to how he's done this in the past, which he's been very open about with, say, Ira, the song cycle he wrote for Don Upshaw, which was written in collaboration with Gustavo Santaolalla and a group of musicians known as the Andalusian Dogs, who helped him put it together in the studio, I think partly because he was late with the deadline, something he discussed freely and openly with me in a public New York Times talk. It wasn't like it was a big secret.
David, composers like Bach and Handel repurposed their music all the time. Copland recycled his Fanfare for the Common Man in his Third Symphony. How is this different?
Yes, well, I think first when you think about Stravinsky and you think about that very famous quote that Anne just brought up, the never borrow, always steal, and yet if you take a bunch of Russian folk tunes and you put them together, you don't end up with Rite of Spring. And I think one of the main differences here is that this piece really is the Ward Bergman piece. I mean, Golijov added a beginning, he added an end, and he arranged it. And then also, when we talk about the repurposing, this is actually the third iteration of this piece in Golijov's catalog. And so he has the first instance I found was a piece called Radio, for string quartet and Michael Ward Bergman playing accordion and a sound artist named John Schaefer that Golijov was commissioned to, for WNYC for an inaugural for their new studios in 2009. That piece then is the exact same piece with just this introduction added as another one called Patagonia that Golijov put on a Music Now concert with the Chicago Symphony musicians in 2010. The first time Golahov claims it as a commission for himself, the second time he claims it as a Michael Ward Bergman piece and for himself as an arranger. And then the third time that it comes through with Sidarius, now Golahov is again claiming it as a commission. And so to me, it's not so much the repurposing as it's the intellectual dishonesty of him changing the title each time and trying to hide his tracks as he's repurposing this piece, sometimes crediting Ward Bergman for it, sometimes trying to take credit himself.
Well, funny you should mention John Schaefer, because that piece, Radio, was actually commissioned by John Schaefer for the opening of We Are the Sister Station of WNYC, WQXR is. And John Schaefer commissioned Radio for the opening of our green space, which is our performance space, our live performance space here. You're hearing Ward Bergman's piece in the background. So that is Michael Ward Bergman's piece, and now we're going to hear Osvaldo Golihov's version. This is Sidarius. So that was the latest incarnation, the piece titled Sidarius by Osvaldo Golihov. And now we are going to hear the one that was commissioned for our green space, also by Osvaldo Golihov. He called it Radio. That was the version called Radio, including the string quartet Ethel, written and performed in 2009. John Schaefer of WNYC, who commissioned the piece, said, "It was always clear to me that Radio was going to be a collaborative endeavor. I knew all of this when I asked Osvaldo Golihov for a piece. And while I did not know the provenance of the big tune in Radio, it would not have surprised me then and doesn't surprise me now that he borrowed it from Michael." Are any of you surprised that Osvaldo Golihov should have recycled this music as many times as he did?
I mean, I think what we're looking at really is something very sad, because I think Golihov has reached a kind of creative block. And I was saying this years ago when I was talking to him about Ira, and I thought, why is nobody protesting that he didn't write all of this music? And yet everybody's hailing him as a great composer. And I think that it's catching up with him now. Suddenly everybody's noticed that he's not writing his own music. I'm just saying that the hypocrisy I see is in jumping on him about it now rather than when everybody was lionizing him, you know,
years ago,
10, 15 years ago.
Right. Okay, I want to give Robert Clarida now a chance to jump in. We haven't heard from you yet. You are not only a composer, but also an attorney with a specialty in intellectual property.
That's right. And there really, it seems to me, there are three ways to describe this. There's the label of plagiarism that has been attached to it. And plagiarism isn't really a legal claim. Plagiarism is somehow it's an ethical problem. You're not giving credit where credit's due. You're claiming credit for something that you didn't write. And it seems to me that as long as Golihov is giving credit to Ward Bergman, there's not a plagiarism issue. or a copyright infringement issue. Copyright infringement is using someone else's authorship without their consent. And the facts here appear to be that he had the consent of Ward Bergman to do all of this. So there's not a copyright claim. What there may be, however, and I think Anne's piece in Washington gets to that, is there's almost a false advertising aspect. There's an aspect in which the public is misled about this work in some way or feels misled, even if affirmatively there's no statement that says, I wrote all of the material in this piece. But that's an implication, perhaps, if his is the only name that appears on the score. And that public perception is a difficult thing for anyone to approach legally. I mean, who would really have standing to complain about that? Are people going to go try to get their ticket prices back or return a CD because it's not really Golahov? There actually was a case about 20 years ago involving Milli Vanilli, the singing duo, and it came out that, in fact, they had not been the singers on their records. That was a false advertising matter. And, in fact, in Chicago, people got refunds on CDs that they had bought under false pretenses because they thought, in fact, that Milli Vanilli was singing on those records.
Who should be collecting the royalties for this piece, Sidarius? And should there be duo billing on the program, even though there's a written agreement saying, yes, you can use this music?
Well, I really think that's between the two composers to figure out how they're going to split the proceeds and how they're going to allocate credit. That's not something that there's a legal requirement that the royalties be split evenly if the parties decide to do it some other way.
David Smook, you're a composer and chair of the music theory department at Peabody. You wrote, the new music community should continue to pressure Oswaldo Golihov to openly address the situation. What do you hope that he's going to say?
Well, I mean, first I'd like to say I take Anne's point that, you know, people should have been talking about this as far back as Ira or really La Passion, I think is well taken. I think the distinction with Sidarius is just how clear it is, how you're able to look at this piece and see it's a 9-minute long piece, 7 minutes of that are clearly borrowed. And really, I just would like to see some acknowledgement on Golahov's part that there was this commission and people were trying to commission a Golahov piece and they got something that was a collaborative piece. And when you go to the Boosey and Hawks website, they still list the piece very clearly as a Golahov piece. There's no acknowledgement whatsoever that there is any controversy about this. Not a single one of the orchestras has stepped forward and said, you know, maybe we're trying to commission one thing, we got something else. And so I just am wondering, you know, when any of the principals are going to come forward and just say that this situation, while, you know, legally everyone might have dotted their I's and crossed their T's, that they're calling this piece something and it's something else.
Is that any different from Ira, which was a huge hit and which openly, I mean, if you look at the CD, two of the movements are fully credited to Gustavo Santaolalla, and yet everybody still calls that a Golahov piece and nobody has made the slightest bit of fuss. You go on YouTube and it says Ira by Golahov and then they'll play the Santaolalla piece. And to me, there's no difference. The only fact is that everybody's buzzing about this one and nobody was buzzing about that one, as far as I can see.
Well, I do think we just have a likely candidate there for someone who might pursue some legal remedies, perhaps an orchestra.
On behalf of the orchestra.
An orchestra that commissioned a piece by Golahov and will now say that's not what they got. And that could just be a plain old breach of contract action to say, we ask you to write us a piece and you didn't deliver that.
But then they should refund their money for Pasión Según San Marco, which was also a collaborative piece, which everybody hailed as this great work, knowing it was a collaborative piece, and everybody called it was by Golahov.
Well, I think the distinction is you say knowing it was a collaborative piece, and it seems to be the case here that people didn't know that until quite recently, until after the piece had been out and been circulating for a while.
Let me just add that we asked Oswaldo Golihov's management for a comment on this, and the manager said he expects Golihov to speak, as he says, openly and publicly for himself on this issue after he has delivered a composition that is currently overdue, and he expects that will be in mid-April.
I would add that there is another piece that you haven't mentioned that I'm sure we're about to get to, but the piece that is being written for the St. Lawrence Quartet, and there was actually a newspaper article about the quartet waiting for their piece, and that was also a co-commission between a number of different organizations. It's called Koholet. I don't know how to pronounce it. And one movement of that piece in progress was withdrawn after a Brazilian journalist observed its similarities to another piece that was used without the composer in question's approval. And Golioff said, I believe, oh, I was more influenced than I thought, and then withdrew that piece. That, to me, is the only issue in this whole constellation that smacks of plagiarism. I mean, I think that as an artistic community and as a community that has lionized Golioff, we owe him or our art more than simply witch-hunting him now on charges of plagiarism. And realistically looking at the way that he's always worked and seeing that obviously he's in some kind of bad spiral where he hasn't been producing a lot of great work, and the works that are coming out are very short and written largely by other people. That's a human story, but to get on his back and say, well, he needs to come clean and acknowledge what he's done is a kind of, to me, a kind of nursery school punishment that I don't think he merits.
Bob, I'd like to ask, are there different accepted standards of what constitutes plagiarism for different musical genres? For instance, pop songs borrow from classical music all the time.
That's true. Pop songs do borrow frequently from classical music, but most classical music is public domain, so there's not a copyright element, and there's not a permission element required. And also, I think there's a little bit of a different standard with regard to classical music. The idea of the solitary creative genius making the classical piece ex nihilo is a much more powerful image, I think, in the classical world than it is in the pop world. Pop singers tend not to be taken that seriously. Pop songwriters tend not to present themselves that way. And I don't think there's the same sort of self-consciousness about borrowing as perhaps there might be in the classical world.
Well, isn't there also in the pop world, if I can jump in, an assumption that many albums are, by their very nature, collaborative, that it can be hard to pin down who created a snippet? Somebody adds a lick here, and the producer does this, and the sound guy does this, and you come up with an album that's a cohesive work that bears the name of the band, and that collaboration is sort of taken for granted in a lot of musical genres in the pop world.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And in the history of art, I mean, there are all sorts of Renaissance paintings where somebody did the hand and somebody else did the halo. And, you know, it was not at all uncommon at the time for pieces to be put together that way. But I do think classical music has a little bit of a different perception of what the composer does. And the piece is seen much more as the product of the composer and nobody else. And that's maybe not an accurate picture, but I do think that's the picture that a lot of people have.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what makes Ayre and La Passion seem a little bit less of an issue in this instance, is especially in La Passion when it toured with all the amazing performers, you know, it was clear that these performers were on stage, they were part of the piece, and just their presence there made it feel more like the pop world, more like that feeling where you have a singer, you have a producer, and everyone's working together. And yes, it's under Golioff's name, but the other people are on stage and they're actually there and receiving the applause of the audience. Whereas in the case of Sidarius, it's going to 36 different orchestras in 35 different cities, and Wart Berkman isn't traveling with it.
Can you explain a little bit more about that for people who don't know that whole thing of the collaborative nature of that?
In La Passion, he used a Venezuelan choir on the Scuola Cantorum de Caracas. He had Luciano Sousa, this incredible singer who was performing, and they were standing front stage center. And it was, and as an audience member, so much of the artistry that was brought to the piece clearly came through these performers and came through these performances. So that seems to be more the pop music paradigm. Whereas with Sidarius, it's traveling from orchestra to orchestra, and it's only Golioff with this, some of them having Wart Berkman in the program notes and this kind of disingenuous program note.
To play devil's advocate, though, just because there is a pop music paradigm and a classical music paradigm, does that mean that there should be, and does that mean that we should follow this sort of tradition that's grown up that says classical music is not collaborative, when after all, you know, in the Baroque, everybody was borrowing everybody's music?
Well,
and
I was about to ask,
it is.
What about the Metropolitan Opera's recent pastiche, The Enchanted Island, where they pulled all kinds of excerpts from operas by all different composers? Where does that fit into the picture?
Well, that's absolutely part of classical music tradition. And this paradigm of the one composer creating the work is, you know, something that grew up a lot in the 19th century and is not even necessarily so great for the field, I would argue. I mean, there's no question that it exists. I will add, however, that when La Pasión Según San Marcos came out, I was somebody who was not so thrilled by it, partly because I was disturbed by the collaborative aspect and partly because I didn't think it was all that new. And I've pointed out a number of times that Leonard Bernstein in his Mass 30 years earlier or so did something very similar. It was a pastiche of a lot of different styles. He drew heavily on things he found at the last minute. He had different kinds of artists involved and on stage, and he was absolutely castigated for sullying the classical temple with all of this vernacular crap. And the fact that Golioff was essentially praised for the same thing was amusing to me.
We have a little excerpt of Bernstein's Mass right here.
For the Word created mud and got it going. It filled our empty brains with blood and set it flowing. And for thousands of regimes, it's endured all our follies and fancy schemes. It's been tough, it's been tough, and yet it seems to be growing.
What about all the classical composers down through the ages who have incorporated folk songs into their pieces? This was Bernstein using a Chilean protest song in Mass. Should all the composers who've ever borrowed music be considered plagiarists?
I don't think any of the three of us was ever claiming that.
What is the difference, then, between borrowing composed music and borrowing folk music?
Well, David said before that you can take a lot of Russian folk tunes, but that's not necessarily going to yield you a Rite of Spring. There's a huge, you know, tradition of using folk tunes or folk influence tunes. I mean, not all of Dvorak's folk melodies were actual folk melodies, but they sounded like folk melodies.
You know, Dvorak would be the exception, but there were so many composers who did. David, we haven't heard from you in a while.
Yes, I mean, you look at someone like Bartok, who's widely regarded as someone who's pulling folk songs together and just stitching them together. But if you take a bunch of Hungarian folk songs, you don't end up with Concerto for Orchestra. I mean, it's, you know, whereas if you take the piece Patagonia and you arrange it for orchestra and you add an introduction and a little coda, you end up with Sidarius. And I think that really is the distinction here.
Well, and also what it does is it there's not a sort of a blindfold test mentality that we're going to judge this piece as if it were written by an anonymous composer. This is a Golioff piece. We carry certain expectations into that when we go to hear it that we wouldn't carry into it if it were labeled a Ward Bergman piece.
I was going to say devil's advocate again that Philip Glass has indeed a workshop and a bunch of assistants, and he's very prolific, and he writes a lot himself, and there's a lot of arranging for the movie things that I believe goes on, you know, under his name and with his approval, not him. In fact, he is in many ways the epitome of the kind of Renaissance craftsman. I don't think that mentality has vanished entirely from the classical music world.
And I've just seen the Damien Hirst dots that are all over galleries all over the world, and you kind of stand there and you think, well, if he's commissioning people to make his dots for them, how much of it is it the idea? I had the idea of this painting. Golioff had the idea of this work, and then somebody else actually fills out colors in the lines? Or
in the article that I did on New Music Box, which on this, one of the things I talked about is the idea of a ghostwriter. And I think in Damien Hirst's case, with the spot paintings, I mean, it's very clear. I don't even think he designs them anymore. He just had this idea, and now it goes forward. With Philip Glass, he has his studio, and yes, they're arranging for him. There's the movie music. There's a more another case back in the 1960s where there was a composer, a very original composer named Giacinto Scelsi from Italy, where someone came forward years later saying that he was the brains behind Scelsi's music, which I think was a little bit more of an instance. But in these cases where we have ghostwriters, you don't see instances, you know, where you have Robert Ludlum, he died several years ago, but he's still producing novels because there are these ghostwriters who take the name of Robert Ludlum. But Robert Ludlum is not being considered for a MacArthur Genius Award, and Golioff, is winning these incredible awards. I think it's what Bob was just talking about, this idea of the brand of Golioff, where we have this idea that he's high art, that he's genius, I mean, he's a certified genius. He could walk around with Wile E. Coyote business cards, you know, Bullahuff genius, and hand them out. And I think that gives us different expectations.
But here's an example where we as a society have elevated him to a position, and now we're angry at him for not living up to what we made him, whereas Golioff, the artist, is not reflected either in winning the MacArthur Genius Grant or in the plagiarism. It becomes a kind of cartoon that's playing around him. I think one of the things that appears to me to be happening to him is a difficulty of living up to precisely this outsized cartoon brand name image that we've built of the great Golioff.
Bob,
how... But don't you think there's a responsibility there?
I think there's a responsibility to do the best you can to make great art. I see somebody who looks like he's kind of buried under the pressure of trying to produce a new Golioff work. And if his response to that is to get the monkey off his back by using a technique he's been using throughout his career without anybody minding, I don't necessarily advocate it to begin with. What I'm disturbed by in this whole thing is the vehemence with which everybody's jumping on him all of a sudden.
And you said jumping on him now. Bob, I wanted to ask, is there a jealousy factor involved here with all the accolades and awards and Carnegie Hall chair and everything that has been thrown in Golioff's direction? He's so successful in a field where so many composers are toiling in obscurity.
Well, I think there's got to be a little schadenfreude here that people like to see, well, you know, he's not so great after all. And there are a lot of other deserving composers out there who aren't getting the shot. I think that's got to be an undercurrent here. And as an undeserving composer myself, I certainly sympathize with that.
David, you're also a composer. What's your take on this?
My take, I think, is very similar to Anne's in that I find it very sad. And I find it sad because I was a huge fan of Golioff's music, even back when he was a student. I would go up to him after classes and just, you know, exercises he wrote for classes, I'd be asking him for recordings of them. And so to see him in this position actually makes me very sad. I can see where the schadenfreude clearly is part of the reaction, but for me also there's the learning experience of looking at student composers and having to say to them, you know, what's right, what's wrong, where are you crossing the line, where are you getting close to the line, so that you can then look back and maybe not get close to that line.
Anne, what is your prediction for how this is all going to shake out?
Oh, prediction. I think predictions are difficult to make. I hope that Golioff finds himself, and I imagine this is going to be something of a watershed for him because it involves everybody suddenly looking at this compositional technique. He's a very beloved figure. He's a great guy. Everybody who knows him really likes him. I've really enjoyed talking to him. So he has a lot of goodwill in the field. And I think the pressure now will be maybe all the more on him to produce something really fabulous, but it would be just wonderful, wouldn't it, if he decided to sit down and write something completely non-collaborative or turn out a really big piece again. It would be great if he could do that.
Anybody else, any thoughts?
Well, I'll just add a pop culture reference and say that the Wizard of Oz was a lot more lovable guy after the dog pulled the curtain back. And then he showed what he was really made of. So maybe we'll have a happy ending like that.
Well, I think we'll leave it at that. That's a great way to end this. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
This has been the latest installment of Conducting Business. Our guests have been Washington Post classical music critic Anne Majet, composer David Smook, and intellectual property attorney Robert Clarida. Brian Wise is our producer and Bill O'Neill, our engineer for WQXR. I'm Naomi Lewin. Thanks for listening.